So tonight is the fourth talk in this series. The first talk was an overview of the whole series of the five stages of spiritual life. And in the second talk, I talked about integration. We explored the topic of integration. In the third talk, I talked about the whole topic of positive emotion and skillfulness. And in tonight's talk, we're going on to what's usually known as spiritual death. So, spiritual death. Subhuti's talked about this quite a lot, and he, at some point, he said he didn't like the word spiritual. He said particularly because he does a lot of teaching in India, he spends about 6 months or so of the year teaching in India, the word spiritual there has Hindu connotations rather than Buddhist connotations. So he said he uses the term dharmic death. So the phrase spiritual death is obviously, it's a metaphor. Actually, I don't like the word death in this sense. Yeah. I'm not too keen on the word death, because although we're speaking metaphorically, we're speaking of a kind of death of egotism or something like that. The word death does imply something sudden. And also, for many of us, it doesn't have particularly positive connotations. Yeah? So I think what we're talking about here is something that can be very gradual and is highly positive. Yeah. So we're talking about seeing through our delusion of having a fixed and separate self. And this seeing through manifests as a kind of movement away from self-centeredness, a movement towards greater and greater selflessness. And the wisdom of seeing through our delusion of ego identity manifests as compassion. It manifests as the compassion of selfless activity. Yeah? So we could use other metaphors to talk about this. We don't have to use the term spiritual death. We could use other metaphors for this whole process, this vision. We could, for instance, talk about spiritual victory. And some of you may have noticed that the title of the talk is The Victorious One. In the Dhammapada, the Buddha says, though one should conquer in battle thousands upon thousands of men, yet he who conquers himself is truly the greatest in battle. It is indeed better to conquer oneself than to conquer other people. So he's using the image of victory there, victory over yourself. We could also talk about freedom of mind. There's a phrase, cetta vimutti, which is also in the Meghiya Sutta, has been translated as the heart's release, which is a really nice phrase, the heart's release. And when Bhante Sangharakshita talked about spiritual death back in the 1970s, when he was introducing this whole series of five stages, he began by referring to it as a stage of vision. So there's lots of different terms that could be used. And whichever images or whichever metaphors we use, the important thing is to understand what we're talking about, what is being expressed. And sometimes it's best to have lots of different expressions to guard against literalism. Because it's quite easy to become too literal-minded about things. It also guards against jargon, because if you use the same phrase over and over again, after a while it becomes jargon, and people will say spiritual death when they mean something quite ordinary, as it were. So what we're talking about here is a victory over all kinds of self-centeredness and selfishness and pettiness and so on. We're talking about the death of the delusion that we have some kind of permanent essence, a self, which needs to be defended and nourished. So we're talking about a release, as it were, from the prison of isolation that is egotism. We're talking about a vision of complete selflessness, which is known in the Mahayana Buddhism as the Bodhisattva ideal. And although we're talking about spiritual death, separate from spiritual rebirth, which is the topic of the next talk in 2 weeks' time, really there's no separation. Yeah? When you're released from the delusion, you're released into a vision. When you let go of selfishness, you let go into selflessness. When you are victorious over ignorance, you gain the kingdom of wisdom, as it were. Wisdom and compassion. In fact, again, in that original seminar when Bhante talked about spiritual death, he talked about it as a stage of spiritual rebirth, strangely enough. So he talked about the next stage as a stage of transformation. So these terms are changeable also, just as everything is changing and changeable. Yeah. Anyway, this whole business of self is very central to Buddhist thought and practice. But it's very easy for it to become quite abstract. It's easy to become quite abstract and alienated from concrete experience. It doesn't have to be complicated and it doesn't have to be abstract. In a way, it's really quite simple. Innate to our experience to perceive ourselves as separate from the rest of the world. Yeah, we are, as it were, subject, and whatever else is out there is object. Yeah, and this is deeply ingrained in us. It's how we have evolved, you could say. But what the Buddha is telling us in the whole teaching of Buddhism is that this is not reality. Yeah. In reality, there is no separation into subject and object. So because we have this experience, this perception of me or I as a subject and the rest of the world as object, we also tend to fix subject and object. We tend to give substance to subject and object, to self and other, me and you, and so on. But Buddhism is saying quite clearly that everything is impermanent and everything is insubstantial. And this includes whatever we think of as me. Yeah? So everything about us is changing all the time. Body, thoughts, emotions. You could say we are change. We are change and everything else is change. So reality is one mass of change, of movement, of energy. Yeah? Everything is constantly arising and passing away, arising and passing away. And everything is arising because of certain conditions and passing away because of other conditions. And all those conditions are constantly arising and passing away. So reality is this constant interplay of constantly changing conditions, arising and passing away. Everything about us is part of this constant interplay of reality. Everything about us is part of this changing reality. And everything about others is also part of this constant interplay of reality. Another quote here in a book called Wisdom Beyond Words. Bhante says, for an illustration of this idea, we can turn to the Gandavyuha Sutra, in which the reality of things is compared to the intersecting of beams of light. If you have rays of light of all different colors, flashing in all directions, crossing and crisscrossing, what you find, obviously, is that one beam of light does not obstruct any of the others. They all shine through one another. They are not lost or merged in one great light, they all maintain what you might call their separate individualities, but they offer no obstruction to the penetration of other individualities, by other individualities. They're all mutually interpenetrating. And in reality, things can be perceived neither as being chopped up into mutually exclusive bits, nor as being absorbed into a unity. When we see into reality, we see all things as interfusing and interpenetrating one another. There is both individuality and unity, neither obstructing the other at the same time. But our attachment to self is part of how we have evolved. It's part of how we've evolved as self-aware beings, and it takes effort and time to go beyond it. The first thing we have to do is simply to recognize that we do have an attachment to self. You know? It's quite healthy and wise to simply recognize this. If we recognize and if we acknowledge our attachment to self, then we can enter into, the game, as it were, of noticing how that attachment to self manifests in the world. I talked about this a bit last week. And we can be quite light about noticing it. We can be quite light about noticing our own egotism, as it were, our own self-centeredness. We don't have to get kind of heavy about it and think about it as a terrible thing. It's simply how we've evolved, yeah? It's where we find ourselves. One of the unfortunate consequences of attachment to self is that it leads to suffering. This is why the Buddha talked about it, because it's what leads to suffering. Because of attachment to self, which the Buddhist tradition calls ignorance, avidya, ignorance, we try to avoid what we don't like and grasp what we like. So aversion and grasping becomes the constant activity of our whole psychophysical being. And aversion, of course, manifests in things like ill will or anger or aggression, or it might just manifest in preferences or whatever. And grasping manifests in greed or in envy or in addiction or obsession or even just in comfort seeking, yeah? And because all of this can never be successful in fully satisfying, as it were, the yearning of our being, there's always an undertow of fear and anxiety, an undertow, in other words, suffering. So when we transcend attachment to self, which means when we transcend attachment to aversion and grasping, then we begin to manifest in the world as a flow of wisdom and compassion, which is expressed as mindfulness, it's expressed as kindness, and it's expressed as energy for the good. And the practices which lead us beyond self, as it were, which lead us to transcend self-centeredness, they can be seen as wisdom practices and compassion practices. So we could categorize them in this way, as wisdom practices and compassion practices. In other words, we can approach the task of going beyond self via the path of wisdom or the path of compassion. Preferably via both, yeah? That's what's recommended. And the path of wisdom practice will involve clarifying our views. It involves getting a thorough understanding of teachings, such as teachings around dependent arising, pratichasamutpada, teachings around the three lakshanas, the three marks of existence. And as well as understanding the concepts, it means reflecting deeply on the teachings. It's not just understanding them, but reflecting on them, taking them into your being, as it were. Somewhere Bhante talks about the spiritual life as being an interrogation of reality. So it means reflecting deeply on those teachings. It may involve going deeply into teachings like the Heart Sutra or the Diamond Sutra. It will include meditations, for instance, on things like the six elements or the five skandhas or the three lakshanas, all of these ways that Buddhism tries to talk about reality and talk about the reality of self and so on. Other elements in the on the way to wisdom are things like silent retreats or solitary retreats, where you can see more clearly in those contexts, under those conditions, you can see more clearly the workings of your own mind. You can see the contortions and the subtle tricks that your own mind delights in, the grasping and the aversion in their undiluted state, as it were, but also in their subtleties. In meditation practices like the mindfulness of breathing or just sitting, your mind will reveal itself. Sometimes we use the phrase when we're talking about meditation, we talk about things coming up. Yeah? And this is an image of something that was hidden or buried being brought into the light, being brought into the light of awareness. And that's all part of getting to know ourselves in our fullness and learning to accept ourselves in our wholeness, as it were, so that we know what it is that we're trying to transcend and transform. Yeah. And some of those other meditations, such as meditations on the six elements and so on, they're about going deeper and challenging our, as it were, existential assumptions. There's a quote I have here from Kulananda in an essay on conditionality. He talks about our need to challenge all our assumptions. He says, "The principle of conditionality shows the impermanent and insubstantial nature of all phenomena. A consequence of this is that they cannot of themselves provide us with any lasting satisfaction." So because nothing lasts, it can't provide us with a lasting satisfaction. "And yet we constantly treat the world as if it were permanent, substantial, and ultimately satisfying. Thus deluded, we are wedded to a nexus of suffering. Not recognizing the impermanent and insubstantial nature of phenomena, we cycle between the twin poles of attraction and repulsion, endlessly unsatisfied, grabbing onto this, pushing away from that. So it will go on until we replace what he calls wrong view with right view, until we cease to behave as if phenomena are permanent, substantial, and satisfying, and start to behave as if they are impermanent, insubstantial, and incapable of providing ultimate satisfaction." So we need a strong basis of positive emotion. And we need a context of spiritual friendship before embarking on these practices that challenge our assumptions and challenge our very sense of self. Yeah, it's important to... The reason we need that basis of friendship and basis of positive emotion is because these practices can be deeply unsettling. They can be deeply unsettling and disturbing. Again, there's a quote I have here from Bhante Sangharakshita. It says, "Things may start going badly for us, not as a result of unskillful behavior, but in consequence of our exposing ourselves to a higher vision. We may even find ourselves thinking that everything was going rather well for us until we took up the spiritual life. We tend to expect that adopting the spiritual life should make everything go much more smoothly for us. But that certainly does not always happen." I think probably lots of us have had that experience, yeah? "The spiritual life may be a happy one, but it is by no means necessarily easy or free from difficulties and suffering. A properly functioning spiritual community will help to carry us over these hurdles. It is as well not to study the Diamond Sutra in isolation, at least not without knowing who and where our spiritual friends are. And I guess whatever applies to studying the Diamond Sutra applies to all of these wisdom practices. So in this path of practice, this way of wisdom, I want to especially highlight the practice of reflection and the practice of retreats. Yeah? So it's important to develop this habit of reflecting, both reflecting on the ideas of the Dharma and reflecting on the events of our own daily lives. Yeah? So we need to study and reflect on the Dharma so that we can understand what the Buddha is recommending to us, basically. Now, for those of us in Sri Ratna, Bhante Sangharakshita has done a huge amount of work to elucidate and to clarify and to contextualize the teachings of the Buddha. But that doesn't mean we have nothing to do. Yeah? The very least we could do is listen to what Bhante tells us, you know, listen to his talks or read his books and go back and look at the seminars and so on. So we need to read and reread and reflect on what we read. When I was writing this, I was thinking there are four books in particular, because there's a whole lot of books, so I thought I'd recommend just four to you, if that's not too much. And there's four books which are a series, and that's Living with Awareness, Living with Kindness, Living Ethically, and Living Wisely. Those four books. I think if you can read and study and reflect on and practice those teachings, you will really be propelled forward on the spiritual path. Yeah. So reflecting on the Dharma and knowing concepts from the Dharma and so on gives us a kind of rich array of tools with which to reflect on our lives. Yeah, we can reflect on our lives from, for instance, from the perspective of ethical precepts, or we could reflect on our lives from the perspective of the law of karma. We can ask ourselves questions about our observance of individual precepts. We can question our understanding and our application of the law of karma and so on. I've just returned from a retreat which was on the 10 precepts, and I was struck by how, although I've studied that text over and over and over again over the last 30 years or whatever, again I could see how deeply it goes, how deeply looking at something like the ethical precepts takes you right into, as it were, the nature of reality if you follow it through enough. Or we can look at our lives, for instance, from the perspective of impermanence and the context of the impermanence of life. Or we can reflect on how egotism manifests in gross and subtle ways in our lives, our fears, our animosities, our greed, our grasping after security and so on. In a way, nothing is too trivial for reflection. Yeah? If you feel grumpy because it's raining or because someone has forgotten a meeting or something, you can reflect on the nature of your own grumpiness. Yeah, you can reflect on your expectations and look for other perspectives. In a way, every way your mind manifests, whether it's something that seems really trivial or something that seems really important, it's all your mind manifesting in the world, and it's all telling you something. And it's, if you can look at that, if you can really kind of drill into it, as it were, you learn things, yeah? And you may even learn things not just about yourself, but about the nature of reality, strangely enough, yeah? If we're worried, for instance, about sickness or death, whether our own or somebody else's, we can reflect on that. What are we really concerned about, yeah? Why? Are there other ways of looking at the situation? What would be a more helpful or a more creative response? So reflection is a really important Buddhist practice, which you can use. Well, you can use it at any time, wherever you are, yeah, whatever the situation. Some people like writing about a particular topic or something like that, or writing a journal even as a way to reflect and go deeper. And I always think that asking questions is one of the best ways of going deeper. the questions are more important, as it were, than the answers. And if you do come up with an answer, then more questions should be almost like the response to your answer. Yeah. So that's reflecting. Then retreats. Retreats are a very specific practice. And the kind of retreat which I think is part of this way of wisdom are those where you're alone with your own mind. Yeah. You're alone with your own habits, your own responses. So these are silent retreats and solitary retreets. Silent retreats, obviously, are usually meditation retreats, and you gradually move into deeper levels of experience, below or beyond, or whatever way you want to put it, beyond the usual everyday consciousness. And that can be difficult at times. You might encounter resistances, or you might encounter unpleasant states of mind, but it can also be blissful and insightful. And I think, well, especially if you don't get on very well with meditation, then solitary retreats are really indispensable, because on a solitary retreat you can create your own program, as it were, and have as much time as you want for reflection. And whatever you do, as it were, the mere fact of being alone means that you have to experience yourself. You have to experience yourself very directly. And that can be uncomfortable too. You might experience boredom. You might experience fear. You might experience craving of all kinds. I think anyone who's ever been on solitary retreat probably recognizes that you experience all of those things and more, yeah? But if you stay with it, you will get beyond those states. You'll get beyond those choppy waters, as it were, and get beyond that emotional turbulence and enter into more tranquil and creative states of mind. If we can't get away on retreat for whatever reason, then you can introduce shorter periods of just doing nothing into your daily life. Yeah. Ratnaguna wrote a book called The Art of Reflection, and there he suggests this as a practice, doing nothing. He says, first of all, you have to learn how to do nothing. This is absolutely essential. By doing nothing, I don't mean watching the TV, listening to the radio, or reading a newspaper. I don't even mean reading a good book, not even a Buddhist one. I mean literally doing nothing. Turn off your mobile phone and computer. Make time to do nothing every day. Perhaps start with 10 minutes a day. Then once you get used to that, extend to 20, 30, even an hour. Make time, or it probably won't happen. Put it in your diary, he says. Doing nothing practice. It's quite a difficult thing to do. It sounds like it should be simple to do nothing. But actually to do nothing, to absolutely do nothing, is possibly one of the hardest things for most of us, yeah? Our minds are incredibly restless, and before we know it, we're off and doing the next thing. So actually getting to a practice of doing nothing is like part of creating the ground for the ability to reflect, yeah? So that's something about practices on the path of wisdom that lead us to transcend self. The path of compassion leads to the same place. And the tradition recommends that we follow both paths, wisdom and compassion, simultaneously. So that's a balanced approach which prevents us from falling into any lopsided errors. So practices on the path of compassion will include things like generosity, metta, rejoicing, communication, friendship, sangha. It will include retreats that involve communication. It might include reflection again, maybe reflection on teachings like the Bodhisattva ideal, the Metta Bhavana, building the Buddha land. It includes puja, mantra chanting. And it includes taking responsibility within the spiritual community. In the last talk, I mentioned generosity briefly. So I think maybe I'll just go into that a little bit more here. Because I think we often relegate the practice of generosity to a fairly low level among practices. And that might be because it often gets entwined with fundraising campaigns or requests for volunteers or something like that. So we, you know, the practice gets kind of caught up with those things, and we think that is generosity. But really, the practice of generosity is much more demanding than that. Yeah, the practice of generosity really is about giving everything. Yeah, it's about giving your whole life. Now that might sound, well, it might sound extreme, but actually, people give their whole lives to something often. Most people probably give their whole lives to something. They may give their lives, well, some people might give their lives to the pursuit of wealth or security or the pursuit of power. They might give their lives to the project of raising a family. Some people give their lives to crime. Some people give their lives to a political ideology. And many, many people are incredibly wholehearted in their pursuit of their goals. I was just thinking there's a presidential election going on in the United States at the moment, and there you can see how people in their late 60s and their 70s are just giving all that energy and time, huge amounts of money, time, energy to pursuing their goal. Just very fully, completely absorbed in it. The practice of generosity, the perfection of generosity, dana paramita, is really about giving ourselves wholeheartedly to the Dharma, giving ourselves wholeheartedly to the Buddhist path, to the teachings of the Buddha. And now there might be all kinds of obstacles. So there might be our own doubt, for instance, our own indecision. There might be life circumstances, and so on. But we carry on nevertheless. We give ourselves wholeheartedly. So all the different kinds of giving, whether it's giving money or giving possessions, giving time, giving energy, giving culture, giving education, giving confidence, giving the Dharma, all these different ways of giving, all these expressions, they're all expressions of giving ourselves wholeheartedly to the path, yeah? And you could talk about this giving, this kind of giving. You could talk about it as going for refuge to the three jewels, going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. It's giving yourself wholeheartedly to the path. So the more wholehearted and generous we are, the more we will encounter our egotism. And the more we encounter our egotism, the more opportunity we will have to directly experience going beyond self. Yeah, and we will be able to see clearly that going beyond self is not an abstract idea. It's not an abstract idea. It's an experience, and it's a liberating experience. So that the practice of generosity directly confronts our deeply felt sense of I and me and mine. So we encounter our egotism in the form of attachment and resistance, yeah? Attachment to things or whatever. I don't know if you've ever had the experience of having a generous impulse but not acting on it. And as time goes by, you discover all sorts of reasons why it would not be a good idea to act on it, yeah? This is often resistance, and it's resistance born of attachment. So attachment is the tendency to grasp and hold on to something, or hold on to someone, to bolster our sense of security and our sense of self. Yeah? And non-attachment is the opposite. Non-attachment is an open-hearted letting go of wants, letting go of preferences, and so on. It's an expansive feeling, you could say, of equanimity. Again, according to Bhante Sangharakshita, the traditional image for the condition of non-attachment is that of thistle down blown on the wind. One is serene, confident, balanced in oneself. One doesn't settle or stick to things because one is self-contained. One doesn't feel the need to reach out for something to make one feel better, to make one feel whole and complete. One doesn't need to be appropriating things or people so as to feel fulfilled. So that he's suggesting that the sense of non-attachment is much like a sense of freedom. Thistle down, blown on the wind. It's just a sense of being completely free and open to what happens, yeah? So generosity is one of the most important practices on this path of compassion. Generosity has no limits, and it's an insight-inducing practice. So the other practices I'd like to kind of focus on under this heading of compassion practices is the practice of communication and the practice of taking responsibility. So communication is a crucial Buddhist practice in many, many, many ways. There's the five kinds of skillful speech that the Buddha outlined in the Sutta in Anguttara Nikaya. Then there's the importance of listening and the importance of hearing, which is one of the three wisdoms. And there's the practice of Kalyanamitrata and the practice of spiritual friendship, which the Buddha declares to be the whole of the spiritual life. So all of these are under the heading of communication. The five kinds of skillful speech outlined in the Anguttara Nikaya, it goes like this. He says, bhikkhus, possessing five factors, speech is well spoken, not badly spoken. It is blameless and beyond reproach by the wise. What five? It is spoken at the proper time. What is said is true. It is spoken gently. What is said is beneficial. It is spoken with the mind of loving kindness. And possessing these five factors, speech is well spoken, not badly spoken. It is blameless and beyond reproach by the wise. So this is what ethical speech is. It's speaking the truth, which means not exaggerating, not understating, not omitting things, and so on. But it's much more than speaking the truth. Speaking the truth has to be in the service of kindness, has to be in the service of metta. Our speech needs to be kindly and helpful, and we need to use our speech to create harmony. And this use of skillful speech is a very powerful practice. You could say that words create worlds. Words create worlds. The poet William Wordsworth put it like this. He says, words are too awful an instrument for good and evil to be trifled with. They hold above all other external powers a dominion over thoughts. So words hold a dominion over thoughts. Often when we think of Buddhist ethics, we often say that the state of mind is primary. But here Wordsworth is saying that words have a dominion over thoughts. In other words, words can change our state of mind. And this is our experience too, especially if the words are coming from outside. If somebody praises us, we feel good. If somebody condemns us, we feel bad. And obviously if we speak badly to somebody else, it rebounds on us, and so on. There is an interplay between states of mind and words and actions. They all influence each other. So one of the ways of generating positive mental states is to act positively and speak positively, and importantly, to mix with people who are trying to do the same. And as the Buddha says, this means being truthful, kindly, helpful, and harmonizing in what we say and how we say it. And the Buddha also mentions this fifth part of ethical speech, which is speaking at the right time, the appropriate time. So timely speech. It's very hard to give any rule for what timely means. Yeah, but if we ask the question, is this going to be helpful? Would this create harmony or disharmony? Is it going to be helpful to the person on the receiving end? Is it going to be helpful to the wider situation? Those kind of questions might indicate whether something is timely or appropriate from a standpoint of Buddhist ethics. There's a sutta called the Badali Sutta, where the Buddha, a monk asks the Buddha, actually, the question is strangely formulated here. I won't go into it. What he's in essence saying to the Buddha is, why is it that when some monks misbehave, they're reprimanded immediately, and when some other monks misbehave, they're not reprimanded immediately? And so Badali is asking the Buddha, well, why is that? That doesn't seem fair. Yeah? Why is that? And the Buddha's answer, well, I won't quote it, but the answer amounts to saying that people are very different, with such differing characters and temperaments, that it's not appropriate to say the same thing to everyone in the same way at the same time. He says that some people can be told quite quickly if they've done something wrong, but other people, those who are a bit more defensive perhaps, it's best to take it more slowly. Yeah. So the point is that speech needs to be timely and appropriate, as well as true and kindly and helpful and harmonizing. So the other important element to communication is listening. In fact, listening might be the most crucial element of communication. It's where awareness and empathy grow, as it were. On a number of occasions, I've been called upon to mediate between people who are in conflict. Yeah, and most of those conflicts, what I saw is that they grew out of people not listening to each other. People not really listening to each other. Interpreting what someone is saying rather than listening to what someone is saying. And of course, interpretation is not the same as listening. Yeah. And the only time when mediation didn't work was when someone actually refused to listen. Yeah. So it's only by listening. Well, listening is also, you could say, crucial to the whole spiritual endeavor. It's only by listening carefully and repeatedly to those who are more experienced than us that we can learn. That's traditionally, that's the first stage of wisdom. It's called Shrutamayi Prajna, listening to the Dharma, listening to the words of the Buddha and so on. And of course, in our case, listening in this way means listening primarily to the words and the works of Sangharakshita. Now, the whole practice of communication finds fruition in spiritual friendship, especially that spiritual friendship between someone who is more experienced, someone of greater experience, and someone of lesser experience on the spiritual path. This is what we sometimes call vertical spiritual friendship or kalyanamitrita. Spiritual friendship which involves an element of guidance or exemplification by the more experienced person. And spiritual friendship is one of the practices that is particularly emphasized in Triratna. And it's a very beautiful and life-enhancing practice. Yeah. It's also recommended by the Buddha, of course, in a very wholehearted way. In the Mahavagga of the Samyutta Nikaya, for those who are interested, there are a couple of three really striking conversations about spiritual friendship. One is a conversation with Ananda, which many of us have heard probably many times. There's another one with Sariputta, who is one of the Buddha's chief disciples. And here, this is how that one went. It's very short. He said that the Venerable Sariputta approached the Blessed One, he approached the Buddha, and said to him, "Venerable Sir, this is the entire holy life. That is good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship." And the Buddha replies, "Good, good Sariputra. This is the entire holy life, Sariputta. That is good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship. When a bhikkhu has a good friend, a good companion, a good comrade, it is to be expected that he will develop and cultivate the Noble Eightfold Path. And in the Meghiya Sutta, the Buddha also praises spiritual friendship. He says to Meghiya, who's a young monk, he says, when the heart's release is immature, that's that same word I was using before, the heart's release, cetavimutti. When the heart's release is immature, five things conduce to its maturity. What five? Here in Meghiya, a monk has a lovely intimacy, a lovely friendship, a lovely comradeship. When the heart's release is immature, this is the first thing that conduces to its maturity. So spiritual friendship and communication are important at every stage of the spiritual path. It progresses from being a practice and an aid to growth. It progresses eventually to being an expression of insight, a compassionate activity. In friendship, we can experience a victory over self-centeredness. Friendship makes it easier to be other regarding. Friendship forms, as it were, the experiential basis for expanding metta. The expansion of metta is the road to insight. In Living with Kindness, Bhante says, forgetting the self as a reference point, no longer asking what any given situation means for you alone, you can go on indefinitely and happily expanding the breadth and depth of your interest and positivity. This is the essence of the spiritual life, to bring about a state in which the whole movement and tendency of our being is expansive, spiraling creatively outwards and upwards. So that's communication. Actually, I've got an image of Ratnasambhava on the shrine because I associate Ratnasambhava very much with that kind of expansiveness, that expansive kindness, yeah? The other area I want to talk about as an element of the path of compassion, the way of compassion leading to insight, is this area of taking responsibility within the spiritual community. And there are different aspects to the practice of taking responsibility. So the first is taking responsibility for ourselves. Yeah. This means taking responsibility for our actions and taking responsibility for our states of mind. And it also means taking responsibility for creating and using the conditions which conduce to spiritual progress. Although it's essential that we have guidance and spiritual friends, we must not expect that our spiritual friends do everything for us. Yeah, we have to act. We have to make our own conditions. We have to examine our own hearts and minds. Yeah. Then the next aspect of taking responsibility is understanding that the spiritual community is not something external to you. Not something that you dip into now and then. It's not, or it can't be, a hobby. It's only a spiritual community for you to the extent that you're part of it. Yeah? So it's important to feel yourself as part of the community, not as a customer, not as a passenger, not as a client, or whatever other word we use. So this means engaging in whatever way you can, being involved in things, in classes or study groups, or helping out in some way, or listening, or responding, learning, sharing, all of that. Sometimes I find it quite sad. Sometimes I see people very excited and inspired, maybe becoming mitras or something like that. And everyone is very uplifted and happy. But then some people just fade away. And often that is because they don't have contact with the spiritual community. Because without contact, there is no community. There's just the idea of community. Yeah. So taking responsibility here means seeing and understanding that your participation is important to the existence of the spiritual community. And then as you see that, you act accordingly. Another aspect of taking responsibility is sharing whatever understanding or inspiration or happiness or perspectives we have gained, sharing that with other people. Well, that's with other people who are interested. You don't want to share with anyone, yeah? And taking responsibility, you could say, is another way of talking about compassionate activity. And it's worth noting that there isn't really any other kind of compassion than active compassion. Yeah? Buddhist compassion, at least, karuna, is an activity rather than some special feeling or emotion. Yeah? So practice in the way of compassion is active, whereas practice in the way of wisdom is more inclined to be contemplative. Yeah? And we need both the way of wisdom and the way of compassion. We need both contemplation and action. Yeah. So those are the two broad paths, as it were, that lead to spiritual death and rebirth. And they also give expression to spiritual death and rebirth. So this aspect of spiritual life that's called the stage of spiritual death or spiritual vision, it's been referred to in lots of different ways. Whatever words we use, whatever images come to mind, the important thing is to have a sense of this expanding consciousness that is less and less concerned with self and with personal preference and personal security and so on, and more consumed by the activity of compassion. And I think it's better to understand this as a direction and a tendency that is continuously clarifying and strengthening in your life, which over time opens up new perspective, opens up new vistas of spiritual understanding, new levels of letting go of self-concern. So these new perspectives, these new understanding and vision and so on, manifests in greater clarity, greater commitment, and greater creativity. Commitment is a wholehearted engagement with the spiritual path, a wholehearted engagement with spiritual practice, with spiritual friends. And we do that because we have seen and experienced enough to know that if we continue, it will bear fruit in a meaningful life of wisdom and compassion. And creativity is the expansive, other-regarding activity of someone who has some insight into the nature of reality. Bhante contrasts creativity with habit and reactivity, which is how we behave when we're still concerned to protect and defend and enhance our ego identity, our sense of a separate, vulnerable and fixed self. So creativity is about breaking the habit of being a particular kind of person, being a particular kind of self, you could say. It's about creating yourself afresh. And as we become more and more creative and committed, this will manifest in our lifestyle and in our relationship to Dharma practice and to the spiritual community. Our lifestyle will tend to become simpler. It'll tend to be less complex, less frenetic, and more integrated with our deepest values. It'll become more an expression of what we truly understand to be meaningful and worthwhile in life. Sometimes this can mean making quite big changes, perhaps for ethical reasons or simply in order to bring more sanity and tranquility into our lives. And that's not necessarily, big changes are not necessarily painful or disruptive in your life. It can be more like growing up and leaving behind the things of childhood, as well, which in this case would be leaving behind things like status and instant gratification and so on. And as we become more committed and more creative, we're also likely to find that Dharma practice has much more the flavor of positive emotion and expansiveness, and is less and less about our problems and our emotional upsets and so on. And as that happens, we find ourselves wanting to serve the spiritual community in whatever way we can, by giving ourselves wholeheartedly and supporting the spiritual community in all sorts of ways. So when we reach the stage of spiritual death or spiritual victory, we will naturally want to dedicate our lives to the service of something greater than ourselves. We will be able to say those verses at the end of the puja, those verses of transference of merits and self-surrender. We'll be able to say those lines at the end of the puja, 7-4 puja, and really mean it. We really mean it when we say, my personality throughout my existences, my possessions, and my merit in all three ways, I give up without regard to myself. May I become that which maintains all beings, so long as all have not attained to peace. So thank you for listening.